I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Healthcare was the leading issue at last night's Democratic debate featuring the top 10 candidates for president. Vice President Joe Biden, who calls for fixing the Affordable Care Act, was flanked by Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who are touting their versions of Medicare for All. Also on the stage, Senators Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, former Congressman Beto O'Rourke, former HUD Secretary Julian Castro, and entrepreneur Andrew Yang. Also on the agenda, trade, immigration, race, guns, foreign policy. At the two previous debates, candidates criticized President Obama, while last night it was largely hands-off. Biden was the target of most of the attacks, although there were some pointed digs at each other. They also remembered from time to time that beating President Trump is their goal. Here's how Senator Harris ended her opening remarks.
So, President Trump, you've spent the last 2.5 years full-time trying to sow hate and division among us. And that is why we've got nothing done. You have used hate, intimidation, fear, and over 12,000 lies as a way to distract from your failed policies and your broken promises. The only reason you've not been indicted is because there was a memo in the Department of Justice that says a sitting president cannot be charged with a crime.
And she ended by saying, and now, President Trump, you can go back to watching Fox News. We have three guests who have joined us on Radio Times to discuss and dissect what happened last night. Dick Pullman is writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania, a veteran journalist who has covered presidential campaigns since 1988. Next week, he will launch a new national political column at dickpullman.net. And Dick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Dawn Teal. She's the Janice and Julian Burrs Assistant Professor of the Social Sciences, also at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a member of the Program on Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at Penn and wrote a book called Forging the Franchise, The Political Origins of the Women's Vote. Dawn Teal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Lovely to be here.
And joining us from the studios of Princeton University is Ale Valenzuela. He's an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University, affiliated with a program in American and Latino Studies and the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics. Ale Valenzuela, nice to have you with us as well.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. A long intro, but let me make sure that you can join our conversation. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, I just have a couple of process questions, and perhaps, Dawn, I'll begin with you. This is the third or fourth, if you want to count it, debate that we've been able to watch on television. Is this a workable format, you think, and I'm thinking of voters, not necessarily candidates?
Well, I'm not sure how much we can learn from a setting where everybody is rehearsing talking points and where the first person to put their hands up is often the first person to be called on. As a professor, I know that often those who are the most eager to chime in haven't put a lot of thought into what they're saying. So I hesitate to elevate a platform where just the loudest person and the most eager gets to say the most things.
And Ali, I'm curious about for voters, how important do you think are debates? And of course, we're more than a year away from the actual election. But do you think debates like this really do help voters make a decision?
I think they do. I think especially in the early period where voters often don't have very much information about these candidates, these sound bites, while I agree with Dawn that we don't get very much substantive information oftentimes from these very rehearsed lines, applause lines, attack lines, these are oftentimes the first thing that many voters are hearing from candidates. So I think these early performances do matter for how voters form judgments that persist throughout the campaign.
I mean, Dick, what we saw and we've seen in other debates is a kind of a split within the Democratic Party. You've got the moderates, I think, exemplified by Joe Biden. You've got Amy Klobuchar also sort of wanting to hug the middle. And then you've got Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren really holding on to the more progressive left-wing part of the party. Did we see that last night?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I wrote this morning, and I don't think it's been posted yet, was that it was, to me anyway, having watched the July stuff, was a real Groundhog Day kind of effect, where, you know, Bill Murray could wake up in the morning and see video clips of all of them fighting over health care and parsing the nuances of their different positions. And this split, again, as you said, between sort of like, for lack of better words, kind of like idealists versus pragmatists, mm-hmm. or left versus center. And I don't know how, you know, I wonder if that is educational for voters or not. The problem that I see with the format, this feeds into it, is that, you know, the networks that host these things, you know, ratings are important. And by the questions that they ask, you know, they need some kind of conflict on screen to get people watching. But the paradox of all that is, I think that, and I haven't seen figures on whether the ratings drop over time, but I think a lot of people just kind of, they watch maybe 15, 20 minutes. They see them parsing things on healthcare, little points that they can't follow.
No.
And so they just kind of get turned off because, oh, they're just fighting again. And I think that's I think, frustrating for a lot of people.
Don, we did have three women on the stage last night, not exactly a parody, but getting closer. Are women judged by a different standard in 2019?
Well, I thought it was a fabulous set of people up there. And the fact that there are three women, I think that's more than have been on a big debate stage in the sum total of our history. I do think that there are double standards, and there are standards for temperament that we might have to hold, that we may hold women to, that we don't hold men to. So the line of attack that Julian Castro perpetuated last night, I don't think would work if Amy Klobuchar was to attack Joe Biden in the same way. And I think that's because we're comfortable with the aggression of men up on stage, but we, to the degree that we want a woman to be in power, she has to basically have an extreme amount of poise.
Well, let me play that clip. I know people have heard it probably multiple times by now, but this is an exchange between presidential candidate Julian Castro and Vice President Joe Biden over health care. And yes, it does get into the weeds, and it does get pretty feisty.
But the difference between what I support and what you support, Vice President Biden, is that you require them to opt in. And I would not require them to opt in. They would automatically be enrolled. They wouldn't have to buy in. That's a big difference, because Barack Obama's vision was not to leave 10 million people uncovered. He wanted every single person in this country covered. My plan would do that. Your plan would not.
They do not have to buy in. They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
Have to buy in. If she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago?
I mean, it's uncomfortable. It's not particularly helpful. It does feel as if, though, Dawn, that Castro was saying to Biden, you know, you're old because you can't remember what you just said.
Absolutely. And it turns out Castro was incorrect in this line of attack. So Biden did repeat what he had said earlier. But I don't think we can deny it that Biden looks extremely old, especially as the hours wear on in the debate. His memory is confused. I mean, he's obviously been there. He was in politics before some of the people up on stage were born.
Right.
And that's, you know, both a credit to him because it's obviously he has the most experience. But on the other side, it's like, well, there are long plane rides that the president has to take. There are very long days. And if you can't hang for a two-hour debate without starting to forget.
Make it 3 hour.
Right. A three-hour debate. Exactly. A three-hour debate without starting to forget your lines, you know, maybe you're not fit for the job.
Ali, I'd love to have you weigh in on this as well. And we should say that Cory Booker was interviewed afterwards, sort of raising some questions about Biden's, I guess, stayability, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, excuse me. I think that is a concern. But I need to disagree with Don on one point. Castro was not wrong about his criticism. So Biden actually said both things. He did originally say that you can be automatically enrolled if you can't afford it. But he also later in his discussion said that if you lose your job, you can buy in. So Castro was referencing the last comment that Biden made about that. And so he was right in criticizing that. Maybe, you know, maybe it wasn't fair because Biden had also said the previous comment. But to me, Castro's attack, you know, it may have been a bit disrespectful, but it may also have been him trying out for the role of a vice presidential attack dog. And, you know, there's one person that we all know is going to be much more disrespectful throughout the campaign and during any of these debates, and that's the president of the United States. So I think this kind of attack is something that Democratic voters and others need to think that need to be comfortable with, is my view.
Well, that's interesting, Dick. What are your thoughts about that? And then we will move on from this part of our discussion. But go ahead.
Yeah, the line that I saw that Biden said was, "This is a quote: anyone who can't afford it gets automatically enrolled in the Medicare type option we have." Maybe Castro was cherry picking something else or not, but I think the way he did it, the reaction in the audience, I think probably is reflective of a lot of what the reaction is at home. That the main target is supposed to be Trump, and in the last debate, they sliced each other up so bad that Trump's name was hardly mentioned. And there was some kind of corrective, at least from Harris, on, for example, to refocus. So I think in that sense, what Castro was doing is probably not going to be helpful. If he wants to run for vice president as an attack dog, Biden gets the nomination. I don't think it's going to be him. I mean, I think it would probably be a woman. I don't think it was necessarily helpful to him. Now, I think what was interesting was there was a comment late in the event that Biden made. He was talking, I think, about educating kids, and he said something like, at home, keep the record player on at night.
Millennials were saying, what is that?
Yeah, there was a lot of joking, and I think I made a crack on Twitter, like, what's next, 8-track tapes? But then somebody reminded me that vinyl is now starting to outsell some of the newer technologies. So he's ahead of the game without really actually knowing. So I don't know. The age thing kind of, I think, again, it does cut two ways. I don't know if Bernie Sanders was helped by the fact he was so hoarse. He sounded old, and I don't mean that as a pejorative.
That he sounded old. We're almost having a break here, but we were talking about Joe Biden before going on the air, and many people felt like, well, he held on to his top position and did pretty well last night. What were your thoughts?
If you watched the whole debate, as I did, I think you could not possibly maintain that position. I think the opening remarks were pretty strong, and he was a smooth operator. But as the night wore on, he became discombobulated about, the stories that he was telling. And it was kind of interesting because he's been there for all of these major things. He can draw on his experience going to Afghanistan. He says he knows Maduro personally, which is, of course, not how you would pronounce Maduro's name. There's no doubt that he has a lot of experience and a lot of connections. But on the other hand, I just don't think that he is tapping into the major sentiment. He just is banking on name recognition.
But he's still ahead.
He's still ahead.
So far. That's Dawn Teel, who joins us along with Dick Pullman and Ali Valenzuela. We are talking about last night's debate. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. Email radiotimes@whyy.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Dawn Teel and Dick Pullman. They are both affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania. Ali Valenzuela joining us from Princeton University Studios. And we are talking about last night's debate. Before we get to our callers, Ali, let me go back to you. We had Pedro Ramos, who was one of the questioners last night. It was carried by Univision. We talk a lot about African Americans and their loyalty to the Democratic Party. Help us understand, I guess, the complexity of Latino voters in this country.
Well, that's quite a question.
It is quite a question.
I'm not sure we have time for all of that.
I was trying to pare that down, but no, go ahead.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I think is particularly striking these days in polling data, really quite recent polling data done by Univision and Latino Decisions, is that a significant share of Latinos are saying that they are motivated to turn out in 2020 to support the Latino community. And some of the research that I've done shows is that those Latinos in particular, when they're targeted by campaign appeals, by campaign ads that reference the Latino community, that reference immigration reform, they tend to be strong supporters of Democratic candidates up and down the ballot, right? So in Texas, in fact, upwards of 38% of Latinos said they're voting to support the Latino community, in contrast to only about 40% who say they're voting to support the Democratic Party, huh. Right? So Latinos are driven by more than just partisan affiliation and partisan policies, right? They are driven to support their community, and this translates though into significant support for the Democrats. Now, it's not a universal thing, right? There are segments of the Latino community that are less unified in support of the Democrats, and Cubans are a prime example of their more divided loyalties between the two parties. But Cubans, of course, as we know, comprise a relatively small share of the overall Latino community. So, you know, I think Trump and his attempts to appeal to the Latino community isn't likely to bear fruit for him this time around.
Has he done anything to appeal to the Latino community, Ali?
I mean, rhetorical mentions about the economy and about how, you know, his efforts there and on jobs should give Latinos reasons to support him, but. Much of his rhetoric, his attacks against Latino members of Congress and other persons of color, I think his response to Puerto Rico, right? All of these, I think, come together to really show the president's lack of concern and really hostility towards Latinos in this country.
Talk a little bit about Warren and Sanders. As we know, they're sort of vying for that more progressive wing of the Democratic Party. How do you see their two candidacies? And they're very different. And Don, I want to get you in on this as well.
Well, they're right
certainly
now,
stylistically very different.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think they're what are they, depending on the poll, they're 35%, roughly speaking, of the potential primary electorate is supporting them. So, you know, there is a very strong constituency for them. I mean, I think between the two of them, and this is just, again, strictly my opinion, and maybe some disagreement here. To me, Bernie Sanders is more of a one-trick pony. I think Elizabeth Warren is a little bit more, has a broader range of and more specific range of policies, and I think articulates them better. And I think, frankly, she's more I think she comes across as a better communicator on television. One of the things I think that's interesting about between the two of them is that Bernie doesn't like to talk about the personal side, about himself as a person. They have to really pull it out of him. He did talk last night. He grew up in a place in a Coldwater flat in Brooklyn and that kind of a thing. But that's very that's rare. Mm-hmm. And I thought Elizabeth Warren did something very interesting at the top of her in her introduction, perhaps to dispel the notion that she's a scary programmatic radical. She emphasized biography. She's A, she's from Oklahoma. B, she had three brothers who served in the military in Texas. She was a part-time waitress. She was a special ed teacher, community college. Her kids were raised with the help of Aunt B.
Aunt B.
Where's Aunt B when you need her?
Yeah.
She was needed. Yeah. So I think one of the differences, I think she has a much more rounded perspective.
Well, Don, and I don't want to, we could talk a full hour comparing these female candidates to Hillary Clinton, but nonetheless, how do you see them as sort of carving out, and we're talking about Kamala Harris, of course, and Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren. So how you see them, I guess, carving out different parts of politics for themselves, different from Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think all three have a profile that is quite different from Hillary's, in part because Hillary was in the spotlight for so many years prior to becoming a political candidate and quantity herself. So that baggage, I think, was extremely harmful to her. Each one of these women up on stage last night is extremely qualified for the job that they are seeking. you know, Warren hasn't run a large organization in the same way that Klobuchar has and that that Kamala Harris has, but she has a lot of experience in the policy world. One of the more interesting features of her biography is that she began as a more conservative. She grew up in a Republican family, and it was through her studies of bankruptcy law that she had a change of heart and realized that the system, which is, you know, her number one thing is going against the big corporations, but like the political system, the tax laws, the lobbying situation, all of these things are stacking the deck against ordinary people. The complexity of bankruptcy, of healthcare, et cetera, is really hurting families. And so she came to what we might think of as now a kind of middle of the Democratic, you know, middle of the Democratic Party progressive stance through her research and through her work as a teacher. And the one other thing I want to say is I did notice that she emphasized this personal story at the very beginning. At the very end, it also came up again about, you know, what the greatest hurdles you've overcome. In that moment, she fell a little bit flat. And what was interesting to me is I think she was sort of – she was past that from the beginning. She got to where she is not because she's been telling this personal story for so long, but because she has been an incredible scholar and an incredible teacher for her entire profession. So, you know, she did not get the credentials to be where she is based on this interpersonal story. So in the way that maybe Bernie doesn't refer to himself in that way, that's not actually her shtick. Her shtick is, what does the data say? What can the plan be for getting the middle class, you know, for refurbishing the middle class for the next generation?
Ali, did you want to add something, Ali? I'm sorry. You're up there in Princeton, and I want to make sure that you're in on the conversation. No, go ahead.
I did want to jump in on this.
Sure.
I actually thought her Warren's discussion of her personal background at the end there was quite effective, precisely for the reason you're talking about, Don. That you know, her shtick is this, you know, wonky, you know, knows all the data, has a policy solution for everything, and so there's, I think, some worry that she is seen as a kind of elite or elitist person who can't relate to the common person. But in that final discussion, I thought she did a really excellent job of telling that story and how she, you know, started, you know, she left school for a time to get married, and then she came back to school, and I felt that was very relatable, and many of us know people that have very circuitous paths to to their final, like, successful position. So I thought it was good, and I thought for her in particular it was necessary to tell that story and really, you know, find a way to relate to more people.
Ali, let me ask you then. I mean, and she, I think, exemplifies this in that she has a new policy every single day. But for voters, do you think, is it these personal stories where you feel, you know, someone, you will never meet them, but that they somehow understand who you are? Or is it, you know, a policy, a detailed policy about how to reform healthcare, or some version of those two things together?
I mean, I think ultimately it's both, right? I think we do want a president who we think can understand the situation that many voters are in, can understand, you know, people who are suffering and in poverty and need the policies then that she has to address those issues. I don't think, you know, one to the exclusion of the other is the way to be an effective president.
That's Ali Valenzuela, assistant professor of politics at Princeton University, also affiliated with the program in American and Latino Studies and the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics. Dawn Teal with us here in Philadelphia. She is an assistant professor of the social sciences at the University of Pennsylvania, also a member of the program on gender, sexuality, and women's studies at Penn. Dick Pullman, writer in residence, also at the University of Pennsylvania. He's been covering presidential candidates since 1988, and he's going to launch a new national political column at dickpullman.net starting next week. Ali, let me go back to you, because you have looked at the voters back in the voters who voted for President Obama, who then voted for President Trump. Help us understand, I don't know if it was a change of heart or what caused them to go from Obama to Trump.
Well, what we find in that research that I helped to conduct is that you know, and we tested a variety of explanations. So we of course wanted to test the most common narrative that that economics were a big part of the movement of working class whites in particular from Obama to Trump. But in addition, because of so much other research in political science, we also felt it was important to test voters, white working class voters, immigration attitudes, so whether they were pro-immigration or anti-immigration, as well as both their local economic conditions and also the share of immigrants in their local area. And what we find is overwhelmingly anti-immigrant bias was the driving factor motivating individuals who initially – who supported Obama in 12 and then switched to vote for Trump in 2016. Economic concerns played a role, a statistically significant role, but the substantive effect of economic concerns was much, much smaller than anti-immigrant bias was.
Dawn, looks like you want to say something.
Well, it's interesting because there's some research by Tiffany Barnes and Aaron Cassis, which also looks at the gender breakdowns. And Ali, I don't know if this is exactly in line with some of your work, but the biggest group that changed, according to Barnes and Cassis, is this group of high school only education white men. That was where they argued that there was the biggest change. And, you know, I think we need to think about the gender implications of immigration, because it may be the case that many men feel that their jobs, men who are less educated, feel that their jobs are at stake if we have more immigration. If you think about the sectors, constructions, you know, some of the services. But actually, immigration is incredibly important for women in the economy overall. So it's like, you know, we talk about the global care chain, and the fact is, women, in order to be able to have jobs and to participate fully in public life, need there to be other people in the care chain. And the people
to take care of their children, you mean?
And the elderly. Because women do the majority of that work, even when they work full time. And so women who have their own aging parents and who have their own children do that work. They do all the invisible labor in the household on average, not in mine. And, you know, the people who would take those jobs if the public provided for them are women.
Oh, that's so interesting. Ali, is there an answer to that? And then, Dick, I want to get you back in.
We didn't look at that specifically, but you know, other work that I've seen would support Don's point here that women tend to be more empathic towards other groups, for example, in society, and that empathy is related to greater support for immigration and immigrants. So I'm not surprised to hear some of the research she's talking about now.
Dick, were there certain things last night that were not discussed that you thought were important? And I'm also thinking the fact that it looks like the House of Representatives is, I'm not sure they're going to call it an impeachment inquiry, but nonetheless, they're making some kind of movement on at least looking at President Trump and some of the things that he has done while in office.
Well, that's certainly one of the areas that didn't come up. I was kind of hoping it would, because it was timely. That the House Judiciary Committee is moving in that direction. And I know Elizabeth Warren is on record some months ago as saying that she favors a full impeachment inquiry. And I'm not sure why that wasn't asked. It was certainly a question that would have sparked some disagreement on there, because you've only got actually, I think at this point, a little more than half the House Democrats are on board with it. But it definitely could have fed into an overall indictment, and I don't necessarily mean that in the criminal sense, but an overall political indictment at minimum of Trump's track record and what he's done as president to monetize it, among other things, and cover up material that could have made a stronger connection with Russia. But I think one of the other things I was hoping that would come up, and maybe it's just hard to frame the question for this, but somebody could have segued into it, was I think there's a large theme that Democrats can talk about with respect to what Trump is doing systematically to the institutions of government, to everything from trying to bend NOAA and the National Weather Service on a nonpartisan call on the weather, everything from that to what he's doing at EPA and rolling back regulations to keep chemicals out of drinking water. I mean, across the board, there is an argument that Democrats should be able to make that or allow themselves the opportunity to make that government is there or to protect the average citizen and that it's not, quote unquote, socialism. To do that, these are things that we actually take for granted. Everybody does across the board. And I was hoping that there would be some opportunity to make that argument last night.
Andrea emailed, she said, I lost all respect for Secretary Castro last night. It was clear his strategy coming in was to attack Vice President Biden, but he did it like a snarky teenager. Do you want to respond to that, Dawn? You liked what he did.
Well, I didn't like that one part of his debate performance, but overall, I think he has a pretty good message. He's, you know, seems like he was a talented debater growing up. He's one of the only ones who can speak in Spanish without flubbing it up on stage. So, you know, I thought this is what they do. And I agreed with Andrew Yang kind of bringing it back and saying, you know, nobody wants to see this right now. They don't want to see this happening. And I think that's definitely true. So I think that they all put it aside and move forward. And, you know, Amy Klobuchar chimed in saying, we have way more that unites us than that divides us in terms of our policy ideas up here.
Ali, anything you want to add to that before our break?
Well, I mean, I can acknowledge that it was a bit of a cheap shot by Castro. But again, I just have to go back to the president. And you know, I feel strongly that that's the least that Biden's going to get from Trump and his supporters. And if he can't handle that, if he can't have a good response to these kinds of relatively light attacks from fellow Democrats, then I don't know how he's going to stand up to Trump and his much harder, much more consistent attacks.
Very quickly, Adam Ramos, up in a break here.
This is why I think Warren has a much better temperament, actually, to confront Trump, because Biden can't help himself with all of his facial expressions when he gets asked about his past. But Warren just sticks to her script. I've got a plan for this. I'm not going to get into this petty stuff.
Let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking about last night's debate. The 10 leading Democratic candidates stood on the stage at Texas Southern University. It lasted 3 hours. I made it through two, talking with Dick Pullman, Dawn Teal, and Ali Valenzuela. And talking to you, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in, I forgot who I was. I'm Marty Moscowen here in Philadelphia, talking with Ali Valenzuela from the studios of Princeton University, where he's an assistant professor of politics, also with us Dawn Teal from the University of Pennsylvania here with us in our Philadelphia studios, along with Dick Pullman, also from the University of Pennsylvania. Dick, you wanted to add something really quickly about what you think was omitted.
Yeah, very quickly, and it came up sort of obliquely a number of times, which was, all right, so some of these big programs that Warren and Sanders and some of the others have, Booker on gun licensing, how would they get this thing? How would they get what they want through the Senate? I mean, it's fine to talk about it. It's fine to debate. But, you know, is any of this stuff practical? Is it going to go anywhere? And I would like to have seen Democrats more fully address the challenge. I'll put it a challenge of if they can't take back the Senate, how is any of this stuff going to pass? And how are they going to take back the Senate if a lot of the stuff that they're talking about is going to be turning off voters in the red states that are hosting most of the contested Senate races in 2020? Medicare for All features taking away 140 million people's private health coverage phased in over time. How is that going to play in red states like Georgia and Texas, as a matter of fact, and North Carolina, and there's a number of others? So the practicality issue to me seemed to be important.
Let me follow up on that, and then we'll play a clip from Beto O'Rourke. And this is an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. It's a month or two old, but nonetheless, it says the most of the Democratic Party's agenda is popular with the public when it's about gun gun background checks, voluntary Medicare for all, regulate drug prices, pathway to citizenship, millionaires tax, a Green New Deal, $15 minimum wage, free public college. Those all are 50% or more. There's a lot right there. Yeah. Now, it falls into the less good idea when it's repeal Obamacare, replace private insurance, slavery reparations, and decriminalize border crossing. So I guess, Dawn, just because I'm looking at you and I mean, these are the issues. These are the ones that, at least for now, are popular with the public. Do you think some of the more liberal members of the party who are running for president are going to lose out if they say we're going to replace private insurance, whether it's a good idea or not?
Well, first, I want to say that I think this is one of the reasons why Bernie running against Hillary in the last election was so important, because to have that, you know, farther left voice in the public sphere for the last 4 years has been very important, I think, for allowing some drift among most people in the Democratic Party toward the left, towards important proposals that, as Bernie said last night, are standard fare in Canada, in the Scandinavian countries. The justice of these basic benefits is almost incontrovertible. I do think that there was this big argument about whether or not, you know, who could be the best person to carry on Obama's legacy in terms of Obamacare. And everybody knows that he should have gone for a single payer option. He would have liked to have done that, but he didn't think he had the votes. So he did as best he could. And as Warren said, you know, we owe him something for that. Now it's time to get the job done and to do something that just makes so much sense. Hmm. One of her most important lines last night was nobody likes their health insurance provider. And she's 100% correct. I have two small children. Both of them were born in the UK. I paid $0, saw zero bills for any of that service. And what's amazing is that I was able to concentrate all my time on what it means to be a new parent and didn't have to worry about all of that stuff. Here, my friends, even with excellent health care insurance, had to pay $10,000 per child. And, you know, the bureaucracy involved in just giving birth to a child is extremely complicated. And, you know, we don't have time in our busy lives to deal with all of that complexity.
Let me play one more clip. This goes back to last night's debate. This is David Muir asking presidential contender Beto O'Rourke about government confiscating assault weapons. It's about a minute. Let's give it a listen.
You said, quote, Americans who own AR-15s and AK-47s will have to sell them to the government, all of them. You know the critics call this confiscation. Are you proposing taking away their guns, and how would this work?
I am. If it's a weapon that was designed to kill people on a battlefield, if the high impact, high velocity round, when it hits your body, shreds everything inside of your body because it was designed to do that so that you would bleed to death on a battlefield and not be able to get up and kill one of our soldiers, when we see that being used against children, and in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
I mean, Ali, a very powerful, passionate response. Obviously, the several massacres that happened in Texas over the summer. What did you take away from Beto O'Rourke's comments?
That was definitely his strongest moment of the debate, I thought. And I think he's right. I think it's hard. Voluntary buybacks are unlikely to work. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, the argument for taking weapons of war off of the streets, I think, is a very powerful one that resonates today in a way that it may not have even 4 years ago. So I think, you know, I think that moment did him a lot of favors in this race. We'll see if it plays out in terms of polling results.
Dick, confiscating people's guns.
Well, you know, I think on the merits, I'm with them. But in terms of, to borrow a 19th century German word, in terms of real politic, I think it's a loser. And if Congress can't pass background checks, expanded background checks after Sandy Hook, How are they going to talk about, how are they going to pass something which involves gun confiscation? I mean, I think it's unfortunate, and I think it's maybe perhaps politically unfair, but I think the reality is that when the Republicans say, and they say this in general, that Democrats want to come for your guns, that gives them, that confirms their overall demagogic argument. And I think in the real world, in terms of the ballot box, in red states, again, that Democrats are going to need to pick up, I think it's hurtful.
Well, Dawn, during the debate, Vice President Biden was asked, you know, you were vice president after Sandy Hook. There was almost unanimous support for background checks. And you and President Obama, you know, by association, were unable to get anything through that Congress.
Yeah, and then Biden distanced himself from Obama strategically and got nailed for that again. But I do think, you know, a lot has happened since Sandy Hook to make the movement bigger. Obviously, the students' movement is bigger now, and this is
and that was part of his answer too.
100%. And you know, this is part of the new moral politics of the left. We have to be, you know, they have to be moral leaders, and Beto was saying that, and I think, you know, I'm less concerned about realpolitik until we've got somebody in the White House. I think that what we need now are the ideas and the vision.
Ali, let me read an email from Morris who says, these debates seem more about performance moderators trying to get sound bites and opportunity for pundits to give their opinion, nothing to inform voters about their detailed positions. Do you agree with that?
I don't think there's nothing to inform voters about their positions.
It's complicated, right?
Yeah, well, but it's true that there isn't a lot of substance. I did want to. I don't know if I have an answer, but I had a question that,
sure,
that maybe Don or others could consider, which builds on what Dick and what you were saying too, Marty, about you know, the gun debate, about the healthcare debate, which is whether it's better for candidates to articulate, you know, an ideal vision or to try to embody in policy proposals the values that they think Democrats should espouse, or whether it's better for them to put forward practical policies that have at least some chance of passage. I don't know what the answer is, but there definitely does seem to be a divide between the candidates up on stage today, between those who are more idealistic on this point, and you know, are fully committed to only articulating you know, the best policy, versus those who are more interested in what can actually get done.
Well, and I'm thinking about something Senator Warren said at a previous debate. I forget who she said it to, but basically, if you don't have big ideas, you know, what are you doing on this stage? Are you sort of saying that, Ali?
Yeah. I think she you know, she's definitely one of the ones on the idealistic side, right, where she wants to put forward those big ideas and you know, think maybe think later about how they might actually get passed. But, you know, I think Dick's concern is spot on, right, that if it's not, if even the easier policies can't get passed, what's the point of talking about these big, you know, pie in the sky ideas?
Yes, and he said your name, and Dawn, I know,
okay,
you want to get
yeah
in as well.
No, I mean, here I have been this whole hour sort of arguing the practical side of things, but
yeah.
You know, you got to get elected first before you could do anything. But on the other hand, I mean, one of the interesting things that's going on with the Republicans and with Trump, and one of the reasons he made it was that when his supporters chant "build the wall," and you then there people talk to them after the events, they don't. A lot of them still literally believe that he's going to be able to build the wall, but they like the passion, they like the aspiration, you know, they like the principle of, you know, this is how we really feel, and so that kind of rallying cry. So the argument would be again, like, you know, that aspiration can be as important as practicality. I think, frankly, maybe to win the next election, the Democrats need to combine both in some successful
go
way.
Go ahead, Dawn.
I think that this, you know, this narrative of whether or not we should just do things because they are electable is pernicious. I think that we think we have a lot of science about electability in political science, and in fact, we know very little. We can't predict with any certainty who's going to win the next election. Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. So I don't think that we should articulate a vision for the future based on what we think everybody else in the world is going to do. That's a herd mentality. And I think, you know, one of the biggest problems with Obama's legacy is that he worried so much about his legacy that he always negotiated from the middle, right? And all of the economic theory says when you negotiate from the middle, you end up farther from where you want it to be. So you have to start with your, get to the reservation price. Don't start there.
It was a sort of a version of what Bill Clinton did.
Yeah.
Let me read a couple of emails, and I do want to just squeeze one more clip in. Steve says Warren spoke about her past, but she failed to mention she was a libertarian Republican until she was in her mid-40s and of her claim of Native American heritage, without which she never would have had a career in academia. Kyle says that wishing that the panel actually had discussed much more about the economy, which really wasn't a big topic of last night. Let me just play one more clip. This is candidate Andrew Yang, part of his opening statement.
My campaign will now give a freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for an entire year to 10 American families, someone watching this at home right now. If you believe that you can solve your own problems better than any politician, go to yang2020.com and tell us how $1,000 a month will help you do just that. This is how we will get our country working for us again, the American people.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
It's original, I'll give you that.
Doesn't necessarily work on the radio, but Pete Buttigieg having this kind of quizzical look on his face. Dawn, go ahead.
Well, some of Yang's ideas, democracy dollars and things like that, are inventive. They are coming in part out of some of the research of Bruce Ackerman and John Romer, both professors at Yale, who've been saying for a long time we should just give the people money. Almost all of development economics that looks at the relationship between foreign aid versus, you know, individual transfers shows that just give the people the money is the best thing for development rather than creating these bureaucratic structures. But I will say that who gets the money matters, because when it goes to men who are heads of the household, there are very different effects in terms of child outcomes, in terms of healthcare, in terms of food intake than when it goes to the women. So who gets the money in the household is an important political question.
Ali, we did a show a couple of years ago about this universal basic income, which is kind of at the heart of Andrew Yang's campaign. And we got just a giant response to it. I mean, pros and cons, but it clearly resonated with people. And I think it's an argument for why you have kind of non-traditional candidates on the stage there, just to put out things that people maybe haven't thought about.
I think that's right. I think that is a good reason to have someone like Yang up on stage, injecting new ideas into the debate. But it's also a good reason to have a wider variety of perspectives in general, right? Why it's important to have more women on the stage? Why it's important to have people of color? Because their experiences, their backgrounds, what they've cared about and invested their time to learn and understand about, they can bring all that to bear on these questions that, you know, up until very recently, we're only talked about and discussed up on these stages by straight white men.
Dick, we're almost out of time here. I'll just give you the last word. We've got another debate in October.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are 11 now.
I think Tom Steyer is supposed to be joining the party.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So any advice for, the moderators?
Well, I would like to see impeachment being brought into the discussion, at least the pros and cons of it.
Dawn is saying no.
And I think Biden, I would like to see Biden sharpen his game, if it's possible. He went through a whole argument last night trying to discuss his Iraq support for George W. Bush's war resolution, and he got completely tangled up. Here's a factoid which nobody really would like to hear, is that the last time the Democrats nominated a former vice president, which was Walter Mondale, he lost 49 states.
Wow.
Now, I know two elections are not the same, but it's a factor, perhaps.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Dick Pullman, Dawn Teal, Ali Valenzuela, thank you all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.